Welcome to Money Sense. I'm Julie Ellenbecker, president of Ellenbecker Investment Group. EIG believes in the importance of education, allowing people to gain the knowledge to feel confident in their personal decisions. This show highlights the unique financial perspectives of its many guests, including economists, attorneys, book authors, business owners, and tax professionals. It is provided for general information purposes only and does not consider your particular investment objectives or financial situation and is not intended as recommendations appropriate for you. Before acting on information on this show, strongly consider seeking advice from your own financial advisor. The opinions expressed on Money Sense do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Ellenbecker Investment Group employees and leaders. Please enjoy today's show.
Money Sense is brought to you by Ellenbecker Investment Group, four-time recipient of the Better Business Bureau Torch Award for business ethics and integrity. Ellenbecker Investment Group is the only Wisconsin investment company to receive this prestigious award more than once by providing exceptional planning and extraordinary service each and every day. Go to ellenbecker.com and listen to Money Sense Saturdays at 2 and Sundays at noon.
Welcome to Money Sense. I'm Karen Ellenbecker, founder and senior financial advisor for the Ellenbecker Investment Group. And we're located in Pewaukee, just north of I-94, between Highway 164 and Highway F in Ridgeview Corporate Park. We certainly do invite you to stop in and say hi. We're also in the Village of Whitefish Bay in the Equitable Bank building across from Winkies. And we have the wonderful opportunity to service our clients in Bonita Springs, Florida. So if you'd like to know more, you can go to ellenbecker.com. You can put a voice with a face, and we certainly hope that you would take an opportunity to do that. This has been a show that I've been really looking forward to. One of the things that we like to do at the Ellenbecker Investment Group is really help eliminate as much risk as we possibly can for our clients. And of course, you know, I'm talking about the risk of the market, making sure people have their documents in place, that they understand what they have. And we can do a lot of that just by how we invest and how we educate our clients. But one of the biggest drains on anyone's portfolio, and it doesn't really matter with age, is healthcare. And so I have invited Dr. Michael Connelly to return and do another show with us, just talking about the book that he wrote, The Journey's End, An Investigation into Death and Dying in America, to help us to get a better handle on how we can understand the importance of the healthcare decisions that we make, not in the midst of crisis, because then it's so hard to make those types of decisions, but how can we be proactive? How can we be better educated on the system we have? So, Michael, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And I'm looking forward to our conversation. And perhaps you could start just by telling us a little bit about, I looked at your resume and oh my goodness, it's like you've done so much in the healthcare industry. You have had so many opportunities to see it from a side that most of us don't. Can you tell us how you made that decision to write The Journey's End, the impact that you hope that it will have?
Well, I've spent my whole life in healthcare, literally from being a teenager to being a senior citizen. And I've had the opportunity to work in all dimensions of it. And I believe that it is in more disarray today than it's ever been. And the area that I'm most concerned about is the care of the elderly, because of that dysfunctionality of the healthcare system. And so I wrote a book about end-of-life care, and I wrote a book about how to change, from an advocacy point of view, the system so that it could provide much better care for the elderly.
When you were doing this investigation and this research, what are the type of hurdles that families are faced that it makes it absolutely imperative that they understand the things that you discuss in your book and the things that are happening in this world of healthcare, especially with the aging? But, you know, every now and then I turn on one of those Chicago Hope, or I turn on one of those shows on TV. And, you know, a lot of things happen. Bad things happen to young people.
Well, I think that the biggest problem, particularly for the aging population, is the fear of dying. And you need to really think about why you had that fear. It's a totally natural, everybody has it. In fact, there's a lot of research to suggest it's the greatest fear that any human has is of dying. But there are really two fears within that fear. And the first is your fear of how you're going to die. In other words, the process, the care, the experiences you'll have when dying. And different from that is your fear of not being here anymore. And those are two different fears and are dealt with differently. But because of those fears, we generally aren't proactive like you're suggesting. And we don't end up thinking about how we want to enter the last phase of our life and be prepared for it. For the same reasons, your physicians and caregivers don't want to talk about it, and your family doesn't want to talk about it. And so all of those come together to prevent people from really developing what I call death literacy. That is becoming informed about the aging process, becoming informed about your care treatment options at end of life. Understand that there will be trade-offs in this time. For example, the trade-off between safety and autonomy. So do you want to be on your own or do you want to get extremely focused on preventing yourself from falling, in which case you may give up all kinds of autonomy. So those are some variables. And then ultimately, if you want to have a better experience at end of life, you need to make some choices and you need to document those choices.
How much control do we actually have over our process of transitioning from this world? I mean, how do we actually have the ability to control that process?
No, you don't control the process, but you can control your choices. And if you become, which is likely to occur, is you're going to, you know, lose your competency, and then things will just be done for you. If people don't know what you want, then they will give you everything. And that is one of my greatest concerns, is that if you understood what everything meant, you wouldn't want it.
When you talk about everything, what are you talking about?
Well,
I remember, Michael, when my father was passing away, he had pancreatic cancer and he was in his 80s and he did not want to die and he wanted everything.
And that is not necessarily an unusual thought process for people. I like a quote here that says, "We often desire, even greedily, to live longer. The question is, what desire is truly desirable?" And so if you understand that the treatments you receive are going to be treatments to individual problems, which may or may not work, and the older and more frail you are, the less likely they are to work, they become a torture. And you end up in ICU, you end up in getting all kinds of treatment that isn't really helping you, but it can be viewed as the only option to keep you alive. And so you may be kept alive, but you are being tortured in the process. You may not be competent. And if you've left instructions to do everything, that's what you will get.
My guest today is Dr. Michael Connolly, and he is the Emeritus CEO for Mercy Health. And Michael has been on the show before. We've talked about this issue. We've talked about his book, The Journey's End, An Investigation into Death and Dying in America. And I just thought, with all the concern that people are having over their portfolios and the piece that we can't help with, is that piece that you take care of your own health, and being healthy, recognizing what's going on in your body. But also, it's such an important thing. We talk about estate planning, making sure you've got your trusts, your wills, your powers of attorney for healthcare and finances, all of those things in place. But it's pretty hard to make a decision when you don't understand what decisions you can make. And with that, we will be right back. Welcome to Money Sense. I'm Karen Ellenbecker, the founder and senior financial advisor for EIG. And my guest today is Dr. Michael Connolly, and we are talking about some of the issues that are in his book, The Journey's End, An Investigation into Death and Dying in America. One of the things that I have found, and Michael said a little bit earlier, is that people don't want to talk about it. And very often when I bring up these types of questions and talk about family meetings, you know, I get a couple different answers. I'll be dead. I don't have to worry about it. Or, you know, my family will take care of me. They already know what I want. And so often nobody knows what they want. It's one of those conversations that are very difficult to start and to stay in. So we talked a little bit about my father passing away, and I still remember him saying, I want you to do everything. I want you to do everything. And my father did take on everything. And the day he took on everything was when the quality of his life stopped. And it was really hard for us to watch, but it was his decision. And we could not step in and change that. And we had no idea what the alternatives were.
And that is one of healthcare's most significant challenges and problems, because I think you first need to understand that healthcare professionals are often reluctant to discuss death. They are trained to believe that death is failure. And therefore, if you want to talk with them about death, they're not going to be very quick to be responsive to that conversation. Unfortunately, they are responsive to treating anything that you have. And that's the phrase, the medicalizing of death, is sort of where we sit today. This leaves those with terminal illness without guidance as they grapple with facing their death and making many treatment choices on how they wish to die. Individuals and families lack knowledge and understanding as to the complex choices of treatment near the end of life. So what are some of those options? And I would say palliative care is one of the most important things for a family facing someone that has any type of a terminal illness. And what you, before you go to the specialist, so let's just take a hypothetical example. Let's say you have kidney failure, or let's say you have progressive Alzheimer's. And in those cases, you're going to end up going to the experts. You're going to go to a nephrologist for dialysis, or you're going to go to a neurologist for treatment on the Alzheimer's. And in both those cases, they're going to take the situation and just look at those specific illnesses and not looking at you as a whole human being that's actually dying. They're just looking at the symptoms to those particular illnesses. And what a palliative care doctor does is they give you a holistic view of your choices. They help you understand what the consequences of going on the treatments are. They help you understand what you want, or you get to get a better vision of what treatment looks like. Because you don't really have a good vision of what treatment looks like. In fact, there are videos that document once people are shown what treatment looks like, they don't want it. But they can't visualize that. They can't comprehend it. All they know is it's the only thing between them and dying, and they'll take it. And so that becomes your frame of reference. But you don't have that frame of reference that what you're going to get is worse than dying. And the palliative care doctor is trained to talk to you and your family. So one of the unique dimensions of a palliative care doctor is that they also view their responsibilities to the family as well as to the individual in terms of helping them deal with the difficult choices. And so the problem is that you need a referral, or at least people think they need a referral. If you don't know about palliative care or you don't know how to get it, the reality is it's not going to be given to you. It's not going to be offered to you. I give you a good example. I had a conversation with an oncologist. And oncologists should be a group that quickly refers you to a palliative care doctor. However, his view of a palliative care doctor was that his job was to tell you the glass was half full, and the palliative care doctor was to tell you the glass was half empty. And he preferred being able to tell you it's half full. And I said, yes, but don't you acknowledge that most of that half full stuff doesn't work? And then he just sort of went silent because he knew the data was in my defense. So one of the places you can get palliative care on your own is through a hospice. And so you could contact a hospice and they would be able to maybe get you a consult for palliative care, and you don't need a doctor to make that happen. You can initiate it on your own. I think it's just a wonderful opportunity. Most people don't know, for example, that people actually live longer in hospice than they do getting active treatment. And so that's a pretty well-kept secret. But the truth is that the pain and suffering caused by a lot of the treatment actually can accelerate your death. And hospice, by not treating you, actually can delay your death and delay your death in a way that is pretty much pain-free and able to enjoy the time you have left. Sort of the classic illustration of the success of that is President Jimmy Carter. He has now been in hospice for over a year. And when he joined hospice, they thought he was going to die in 2 to 3 days. And that isn't just an isolated example. There's actually lots of studies which document this outcome. The health system's design is sort of designed against this. So the first thing before you go to hospice is a doctor is supposed to certify you're going to die in 6 months. Well, there's no clinical evidence that a doctor can accurately predict that you're going to die in 6 months. So most physicians' response is they don't want to document it or certify it, so they don't recommend it. And they do recommend it when you've got 2 or 3 weeks left to live, because then it's safe to make the prediction. But what you really need is it 6 months or more in advance, not at the last minute. But the way hospice seems to work is that it becomes a last minute option. And so if you understand this and you're able to request those consultations earlier, so before you go into a lot of chemotherapy and radiation therapy at an older age, you know, the benefit of a palliative care consult is that they would give you perspective on what that means. You still make the choice, but it would be an informed choice instead of a choice that's pretty much based on believing it's the only thing to treat you. But there are consequences for seeking that treatment. So another problem with the system is that it actually considers it fraud if you live past 6 months. So because of some absurd reimbursement rules, they actually audit hospices for people that live longer than 6 months. And I doubt they audited Jimmy Carter, but it's actually absurd. And the reason they do this is they think it's going to cost Medicare more to have you in hospice more than 6 months. But they weren't studying the fact that Medicare is actually saving a lot of money by not having you get regular treatment. And so the University of Chicago just did a big study on this and found that Medicare actually saves $3.2 billion annually on people in hospice. And yet the design of the system is to prevent you from getting in and trying to kick you out, even though that makes no sense from a quality point of view or a cost effectiveness point of view.
And many people do hospice at home.
They all 95% of hospice is at home.
Yes. Because I think when you hear that word, you think that they're somewhere, but it's very often right in your own home.
It is almost always in your home. They have what they call respite care. And sometimes families need a break, or you get a particular complication that requires more intense help. And they do put you in a facility, but it's generally just for a short period of time.
My guest today is Dr. Michael Connolly. He has written a wonderful book, The Journey's End, An Investigation into Death and Dying in America. And today we're talking about many of the things that he discusses in his book. One of the things, Michael, that I wanted to mention was that you talked about patients with Alzheimer's, and I've had quite a bit of experience with that and that process. Can we talk a little bit, and I know that we're going to talk about the powers of attorney for healthcare within the context of our show, but so often families don't really deal with the issue until it's too late, where that that loved one cannot make those decisions anymore. Can you talk about the importance of being proactive and having that conversation and having those documents in place? Because people's hands are pretty much tied if you haven't done that. And with that, we'll be right back. Welcome to Money Sense. I'm Karen Ellenbecker. I'm the founder and senior wealth advisor for the Ellenbecker Investment Group. My guest today is Dr. Michael Connolly. I could go into his career, but it is like 4 pages long, and it's all in healthcare. And it has been, it really showed me the depth of what you know, Michael, in order to actually be framing out for people the importance of understanding what their alternatives are when they get sick. But as I heard you speak earlier, you incorporated into your talk that sometimes it's a patient with Alzheimer's. And I've had so many patients in clients that have been in that situation, and it can be drawn out, and it can be very difficult to watch that happen. And very often families are, their hands are tied because they weren't willing to acknowledge that there was an issue, and they weren't willing to talk to their parents about it. And I've also found in working with my own clients that husband and wives really cover up very well for each other. And sometimes it's really pretty late before you can understand how far advanced some of these situations are.
So it is entirely natural in the aging process to not want to accept the inevitable. You know, one way to think about it is as you get older, you can't do things you did before. And, you know, for me, realizing that I'm not really going to be able to teach my grandson how to kick a football anymore or even throw a long pass, it just, the body won't do it. And You know, and that is an absolutely horrible thing for me to accept. I mean, it is a very difficult, or I watch some friends experiencing that they really can't hit the golf ball anymore and they keep doing it, you know, and it's, and so it, the thing is, you're not avoiding this is going to happen. It's going to happen. And so I think then you need to think about, well, what are the consequences if you don't do something about it? So if I don't stop throwing that football, I could, you know, end up with a rotator cuff surgery in my arm. And if you ignore the fact that you need somebody else to start making your financial decisions for you, you're going to have a disaster on your hands because you're likely to make some bad decisions. And in fact, in my research, I discovered that this was like one of the top two or three concerns of every financial advisor. Because they actually see people starting to make decisions that they've known for years they would have never made. But they still want their autonomy and they're going to say, no, I'm going to do it. So, you know, for me personally, I actively managed my portfolio until about a year ago. And then I began to accept that it's pretty likely this is getting a lot more complicated that I need to turn it over to a professional and keep my mind out of any decisions about it. So I've done that. And I think it's a great thing. You know, even looking at facing living in assisted living facilities is another way of sort of, you know, if you think you're going to keep going for a long time, you're going to have this very gradual decline. And unless you have resources available to help you with that. So it is accepting that. And, you know, that is the greatest challenge in this whole space. Because the human condition doesn't want. It's this fear of death is the number one fear every person has. But if you start studying what the consequences are, it becomes a little more acceptable to you to avoid getting yourself into these situations so that you may turn it, get a power of attorney for your children, with your children and or whoever you trust to do that. You definitely need to do that for your health care because it's highly likely. And Alzheimer's is sort of the most predictable situation. And it's also the fastest growing illness for the elderly. So, I mean, it is likely that all of us are going to get some form of Alzheimer's. And it's likely we're going to gradually lose our ability to make good decisions. And so and let's just talk about the health decisions as distinct from the financial decisions and say that what is important to you in living? Is it living to no longer be able to make decisions? Is it living to no longer take care of your daily bodily functions? Is it living not to recognize your loved ones? Is that living? If it's not what you would consider living, do you want to continue to get every treatment there is to keep you alive? And because that's what the system is designed to do. So
you're in a terrible car accident or something happens. And you're in the emergency room and they resuscitate you, but you never come back and you end up going into ICU or somewhere else. And you're not really living, but you're breathing.
And that is a very common occurrence, unfortunately. And a lot of times people stay in that condition for a long period of time because no one wants to make a decision. And because no one wants to, and so that's why it's important to articulate to your loved ones what being alive means to you. Because if you have informed them that you don't want to live that way, there's a story in my book about my mother. My mother was pretty clear. She didn't want to live like that. And she ended up having an embolism after a hip surgery. And she became, you know, basically in a vegetative state. And as much as I had great struggle in accepting that she was dead, and I wanted to postpone that, I didn't want it to happen, I also knew that she did not want to live that way at all. And so it was a great battle between the head and the heart. And the heart was saying, keep her alive. And the head was saying, no, she doesn't want that. And so those are not easy decisions to make. But fortunately, she had been very clear to her children about that's what she didn't want to live that way. And it made it easier for us to make that decision.
What are some of, I think what we'll do is we'll take a quick break. And when we come back, these are really tough questions. And for my audience, those who are sitting there, my own children, saying, my mom is going to be 75 years old this summer. What are the things that they need to be talking to me about? What are the things to open those conversations and to encourage parents to look at this from, you know, I want to say an impersonal viewpoint, but certainly it's not. I mean, and I'm not afraid of dying, but boy, I don't want to die. I want to be around to see my grandkids and my great granddaughter and all the things that I'm working on and, you know, in my life. I want to be around to experience it. But the truth of it is, at some point, you know, I'm not going to be. And what does that mean? So we'll take a quick break and then let's talk about it from the adult children's perspective. Welcome to Money Sense. I'm Karen Ellenbecker. My guest today is Dr. Michael Conley. We've been talking about some of all of the things that are in his book, The Journey's End, An Investigation into Death and Dying in America. And it's such a difficult conversation because I've talked to Michael in the past. And I think after that show, I said to my kids a few little things and they kind of squinted at me and didn't really want to listen to me. And I dropped it. I dropped the subject, Michael. I have to say, I didn't follow through with what I was thinking after talking to you. And so as an adult myself aging and as having children, adult children that are going to be the ones that are going to step in, they're my tribe. How important is it to have these conversations and how can you get them started?
So it's extremely important and very unpopular. And so, I mean, and I actually think that the adult in the room needs to be the parent. because, you know, you have to understand your children, you know, want you forever. And so you're the one that's going to have to say, well, but I'm not going to be here forever. And I want you to know what living a meaningful life means to me. And so if I'm no longer able to talk with you and I'm no longer able to take care of myself, I don't want to go to the hospital again. I don't want to go into ICU. And if I'm in that condition and I get an infection, maybe I don't want an antibiotic. I mean, these are very concrete ways to talk about. And really, my book helps you understand, you know, what those choices are and how it works. Every chapter has a story that's a real story about somebody's life that really illustrates the specific issue involved. You know, for example, my sister didn't understand how to access palliative care or hospice, but she had such a horrific experience with the healthcare system that I introduced her to the idea, and it was the best end of life choice she ever made. And had a very, very nice outcome. Or I talked about my mother passing and having to make that choice, even though, but I benefited from my mother having communicated with me that she didn't want to live that way. And so many children actually give great testimony to the fact that having an advanced directive that is precise. And so one of the confusing things about advanced directives is that the last place to fill it out is in a lawyer's office. Because a lawyer does not, the importance of the advanced directive isn't complying with the law. The importance of the advanced directive is to communicate to both your family and the caregivers what treatment you want and what treatment you don't want. And general statements like no extraordinary care, which is how the boxes that get checked are done, is of no value. Because if you say, I want no extraordinary care, no one knows what that means. It doesn't do any good for the caregivers, the doctors. It doesn't do any good to your family. You need to be more precise about what you don't want. And so you can talk about if you no longer have your ability to make decisions or to articulate or to recognize family members, or if you're not able to take care of yourself in any way, do you want to keep getting treatments for things that will arise? Or do you continue to want preventative treatment? You know, one tough one would be, you still want to keep taking your hypertension medicine, for example. I mean, if you are no longer in a state that allows you to live the way you'd like to live, why are you going through all that prevention? You know, the other thing is that as you age, you want to eat less, and you actually live longer the less you eat. And, you know, and so feeding tubes are generally, unless there's a likelihood that you're going to get off that feeding tube and recover, which is a different situation. But if you're going to be on a feeding tube for the rest of your life, it's a horrible existence. And so those are, understanding those treatment, same thing with a ventilator. And, you know, it got quite obsessed in during COVID about the access to ventilators. And for people that were going to recover, that was incredibly important. But there were also people put on ventilators that weren't going to recover. Now, is it true that we don't know the answers to whether you're going to recover or not recover? And that sort of leads to the difference between hope and realistic expectations. And so, you know, the definition of hope in some ways is something that's unlikely to happen. And versus the practical reality of what's likely to happen. And if you make your health choices based on just hope, without understanding the practical consequences of what will happen, you need a blend of the two in order to make a good choice.
You know, Michael, an example, my mother, when she was passing, she had been on dialysis. She had had ovarian cancer when she was in her 50s. But from that, it did some damage to her organs that appeared as she aged. And my mother was on dialysis, and then she fell and broke her pelvis, and they had to get her up and down to do the dialysis, and she was in such excruciating pain. And my dear sister, who had her power of attorney for healthcare, was stuck in the hope that she would get better. And they kept telling us that It was going to be painful, the healing, because she was up and down to do dialysis. And it took my sister 3 days to be able to sign that, even though we encouraged her, and it was so difficult to watch. But she was truly trying to do the best thing for my mother, and she was in hope. And she kept saying, "Mom always bounces back. She always bounces back." But she couldn't see that this was a time that bouncing back was not the type of quality of life my mother would have wanted.
And you know, sadly, this happens over and over again. And all I'm really encouraging people to do is to prepare for these things. So now that you have had that experience, you are better prepared to make that choice for yourself or for someone else. But until you think about these things and experience these things, if you're just doing it for the very first time, you're going to lean on hope almost exclusively. But once you've had the experience, there was an interesting study done at the University of California, Berkeley, this was about 30 years ago when there was a new treatment that came out for cancer that was people hoped would work, but really didn't have any interest in making it work. And they required the families to talk to families that had had the treatment before they made a decision. And once the families talked to other families that had been through it, almost nobody chose to get the treatment. So that's an example of when you become informed, how you make different choices.
So in terms of your book, give my audience a way that they can get it. It's on Amazon, of course. And is there other ways that they can get more information on this, the subject that you're talking about?
Yes. I actually have a website, thejourneys-end.org. And I have written blogs and articles that go into each of these items in great detail, and it's free. And so you could go there. It's, you know, life's easiest solution to everything is order it on Amazon. And that is the easy way to do it. You could go to the local bookstore and ask them to get it for you, which is a way of helping them. But all of those options, the only thing I would encourage you is to think about these things. And the other is to get a good primary care doctor, which is hard to do in today's healthcare. I have a lot of work on that issue, but having a good primary care doctor to have conversations. And by the way, nurse practitioners are phenomenal, and have any concerns about having these conversations with your nurse practitioner, who may have more time and be more thoughtful in that conversation.
And I guess, you know, it's always an important time for people to look at holidays and gatherings that they can get together and have these conversations with their parents. A really important thing. My guest today is Dr. Michael Conley. He has written a great book, The Journey's End, An Investigation into Death and Dying in America. Michael, once again, thank you so much for being my guest. And as always, I hope that I've made a difference in your personal and financial well-being. Remember, before we plan, before we advise, before we invest, we always listen. Have a really great day. Thank you.